We know more about the moon and Mars than we do about some of our deep oceans.
Exploring Alaska's undiscovered seafloor. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, January 25th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaska's congressional delegation reacts to the president's State of the Union speech.
You can't talk about oil and gas if you don't talk about Alaska. We're an important part of this equation.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
This month, a team of British scientists made headlines when they announced the discovery of a whole world of new species that live in total darkness around underwater volcanic vents in Antarctica. Seaweeds, crabs, and even an octopus. These creatures can withstand high temperatures, and they consume bacteria that get their energy from the chemicals emanating from the Earth rather than the sun. Alaska probably has species like this as well. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
Alaska's undersea environment is mostly unexplored, so new discoveries are not all that surprising. In 40 years of experience in these waters, Steve Jewett, the University of Alaska Fairbanks diving officer, has made plenty of discoveries. And in 2006, when the Federal Environmental Monitoring and Assessment Program was willing to fund a 1,000-mile survey along the Aleutian Chain, he jumped at the chance.
We had a mission that went out there looking at the nearshore zone from zero to 20 meter depths, all the way from Unimak Pass to Attu. And what a great opportunity that was.
It's a rare opportunity. The Aleutians are remote and costly to operate in. A diving expedition can easily run up expenses of $10,000 or more dollars a day. But ecologically and aesthetically, the area has a lot to offer.
When I made my first dive, it almost took my breath away how beautiful it was out there, just simply because you have such great visibility, and the diversity of colors and marine life is just astounding.
The islands lie between two ocean systems and right next to the Aleutian Trench at 24,000 feet, one of the deepest places on Earth. These natural forces give rise to unique ecosystems.
We thus far have published on 19 new species.
They've got plenty more new species they're still working on confirming. Jewett estimates 40 or so. Most of the confirmed new species are sea stars. There will be a book of them coming out soon. But the real star of the show is an algae called Golden V. Kelp. It was found in the Four Mountains group between Samalga and Amukka Passes, an area abounding with volcanoes, beneath which the divers found more volcanic activity on the seafloor.
It was like diving in a can of ginger ale, you know, initially. And then there were places where there were just large amounts of hot water coming out of the ground. You could go over there and stick your hand in the sand, and it was just nice and toasty warm. And one of our new species of brown algae was collected adjacent to that region.
The discovery was announced in 2008. Subsequently, a group of Pribilof Island schoolchildren found another colony of the same kelp and announced that discovery. This kelp is not just a new species, but an entire new genus, and perhaps even more special. The scientists hope to confirm chemically and genetically that the kelp is also a life form that gets its energy from volcanic vents rather than from the sun. Photographs of the kelp do not show any smaller creatures consuming it. Michelle Ridgway of the Alaska Deep Ocean Research Institute is very interested in this kelp.
Is the species likely associated with the geochemistry that's unique to those volcanic islands? Probably yes. I think that they're definitely on to something. The only other location that kelp has been found is on St. George Island, and there's a lot of it around that rock. And there are some suspected vents in that vicinity as well.
And there's plenty more. Some 115 color images of what they found in the Aleutians in a book from the University of Chicago Press now being republished by the University of Alaska Press, called Sea Life of the Aleutians, An Underwater Exploration. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Alaska's congressional delegation appreciated President Obama's call last night to cut red tape and spur employment, energy development, and innovation. But the Republicans in their ranks question his plan to make that happen. The president delivered his State of the Union to a joint session of Congress in the U.S. House chamber. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
President Obama's comments on energy were of special interest to the Alaska delegation.
And nowhere is the promise of innovation greater than in American-made energy. Over the last 3 years, we've opened millions of new acres for oil and gas exploration. And tonight I'm directing my administration to open more than 75% of our potential offshore oil and gas resources.
But Alaska's Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski says the president is painting a rosier picture than the reality.
The president almost made it appear that he was taking credit for the increased production in this country for oil and gas.
Murkowski spoke with APRN last night near the Capitol subway, taking senators back to their offices after the speech. She says she was pleasantly surprised the president spent a good 6.5 minutes of what was about an hour-long speech talking energy and included a popular Republican talking point about having an all-of-the-above strategy, meaning it should include all types of energy development, from solar to nuclear. He included in the mix natural gas, touting a domestic supply that could last 100 years. Murkowski says the White House now needs to keep bureaucracy from hamstringing the process.
I did note with great interest that he seemed to be very favorably inclined to natural gas, which is good. It's critical for this country in terms of the resource and in terms of the jobs. It's going to be very important for us in Alaska as we seek to find a market for our natural gas. But I also recognize that there are some within his agencies that are not so keen on all aspects of natural gas.
Alaska's Democratic Senator Mark Begich says he was also pleased to hear President Obama linger on energy issues, but he wants to hear more details, especially as it relates to the 49th state.
You can't talk about oil and gas if you don't talk about Alaska. We're an important part of this equation. So I feel he could have been more specific about how he's going to do that.
Begich says he heard an overall upbeat message about where the American economy could head in the months to come, and he liked the president's call to cut down on wasted paperwork, stalling, and regulations.
But I also heard him say, in regards to road construction and infrastructure, to cut the red tape through executive order, I'm all for that. We got a lot of great projects in Alaska and across this country, and DOT and the bureaucracy over there just kills these projects and costs a lot of money.
Alaska's Republican Congressman Don Young agrees with Senator Begich. He gave the president only a couple standing ovations last night, most notably when Obama said it's time to stop rewarding businesses that ship jobs overseas and called for tax reforms, giving companies incentives to hire American. But Congressman Young dismissed the president's energy policy as smoke and mirrors. Senator Murkowski summed up a sentiment echoed by her Alaska colleagues.
He was saying the right words. We need to pull back on regulations, but he must put action behind the words.
How much will get done in the coming months is questionable, given the partisan divides in Congress and the November battles for the White House and control of the House and Senate. Last night, though, Alaska's delegation sat with members of the other party. Congressman Young, who rarely attends State of the Union speeches, went at the invitation of Hawaii Democrat Mazie Hirono. Senator Begich sat with Maine Republican Olympia Snow. And Senator Murkowski, a big proponent of the movement for bipartisan seating, was joined by Colorado Democrat Mark Udall. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, there's no shortage of ice in Fairbanks for the World Ice Art Championships.
This has been a killer of a winter. We're harvesting ice earlier than we normally would because the ice is just starting to get so thick.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. 8 hours after you quit smoking, your blood oxygen level returns to normal. In 3 months, your lung function improves up to 30%. And 10 years after you quit, your risk of dying from lung cancer is about half that of a smoker. But right now, you're one cigarette closer to cancer. every cigarette makes you sick, so quit smoking today. Information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
An Army Corps of Engineers fraud case described by prosecutors as one of the largest involving government contracting has seen a break as a former employee has agreed to plead guilty. Court papers show Michael Alexander plans to plead guilty to bribery and conspiracy to launder money. Alexander and three other men, including another Army Corps of Engineers employee, were indicted in October on charges of participating in a bribery and kickback scheme in the awarding of $20 million in government contracts. The other men have pleaded not guilty. One of those men is Harold Babb, a former manager with EAC Tech, a Virginia-based subsidiary of the Alaska Native EAC Corporation. EAC Corporation has not been implicated in any wrongdoing. Prosecutors say government work was directed to a favored information technology subcontractor in exchange for kickbacks that paid for real estate, fancy clothes, and other luxuries. The Crime Summit meeting in Juneau today gathered reports and ideas from agencies and outside organizations working in and around the state's criminal justice system. Lawmakers got a look at the size of the job going on in the court system, which includes 43 locations around the state. Nancy Mead, general counsel to the court system, says more than 162,000 cases were filed in the system during the last fiscal year.
Half of all filings are minor offenses, a quarter civil and about a quarter criminal. And just so the vocabulary is clear, minor offenses are basically violations, infractions, and other non-jailable offenses. These are things charged on a citation or a ticket, and I just think of them as traffic tickets, although they include other things as well, fish and game tickets, etc. So as you can see, that's huge, and they are growing.
She said the most complex cases are felonies, with 6,400 cases filed last year. About 4,000 old cases also require judicial review. In nearly three-quarters of those new felony cases, the defendant entered a guilty plea before actually going to trial. Prosecutors dismiss nearly a quarter of the cases before going to trial. The public defender's workload corresponds to the statistics shown by the court system. Director Quinlan Steiner says he's seen a steady increase in felony filings, 10% over the past 5 years. Steiner called for earlier screening of cases to avoid often intense work that goes on for cases that never go to trial.
That kind of resolution, if done up front, leads to appropriate results, which benefits the system as a whole. It benefits clients. They get their cases resolved. The resolutions closely match the facts of the case, and what flows from there, in my opinion, is a benefit to the defendant. It maximizes the rehabilitative potential.
Senate Judiciary Chair Hollis French said the exchange of information between Public Defender Steiner and Court System Counsel Mead showed the benefit of the summit, having people with various voices in the room at the same time.
That's a perfect example of where it looks like we can now turn to the Department of Law and say, give us some more information about why you're accepting cases only to decline them later. How much time are we spending on them? How much money are we spending on them? How are people's lives affected by the filing of this charge? It's later dismissed, and find out more about that.
French said that new legislation is not necessarily the expected result of the summit. He says sometimes the best result is to get people to consider new ideas. House and Senate Finance Committees have begun their overviews of the budgets Governor Parnell introduced last month, and the Legislative Finance Director warned the Senate Finance Committee this week that lawmakers should consider including some appropriations in the final budget that were absent from the governor's plan. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes reports.
One of the state's biggest unfunded obligations is to the state retirement benefit system. The state has some catching up to do in that area due to investment losses and to errors made by a consulting firm that projected lower future costs. Speaking to the Senate Finance Committee, legislative finance analyst David Teal says the state is paying into the system, but not enough. He says if it continues its present course, the state ultimately would be paying as much into the retirement system as it now puts into schools.
Where we are now is just over $600 million in state aid to retirement systems. That quickly goes to 800 and then right on up to nearly $1.2 billion per year. That's as much as you're spending on K-12.
Teal says the state retirement benefit system is due about $11 billion, and the state would benefit if it paid off a chunk of that now.
The amount of savings in the future that that would give you are roughly $400 million a year. Or looking at it slightly longer term, with an upfront contribution of $2 billion, the savings amount to almost $5 billion. And, of course, that's only through 2025. That savings continues, as this chart shows. It goes way beyond 2025. So the payoff is substantial.
In addition to paying down the retirement benefits system debt, Teal says the state should look at reducing state agency operating costs, which he says have been growing at an average of 7.8% per year. He says the governor's proposed budget limits the growth of state agency costs to 3.3%, which Teal says will be hard to achieve. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
It looks like a second consecutive year of mild job growth for Anchorage as the city continues to emerge from the employment dip experienced in 2009. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Even after three decades of data collecting and trend seeking, state labor economist Neil Fried still revels in statistics, particularly when he spots a new record. In 2009, for the first time in 20 years, Anchorage lost jobs. In 2010, there was a slight employment recovery. And last year, Fried says Anchorage reached a new milestone.
By 2011, again, we can say that there are more jobs in Anchorage's economy than ever in its history. And hopefully we'll be able to say that for another 20 years.
Fried spoke at this week's Anchorage Chamber of Commerce's Make It Monday luncheon. If his prediction for 2012 proves true, Anchorage, bolstered by generally positive state economic trends, will be able to notch another employment high mark a year from now.
I'm predicting 1,000 new jobs. If someone said, Neil, do you think you're being too optimistic or too pessimistic? I'd probably say pessimistic. I tend to be that way. I'm just, you know, economists tend to be a little on the dark side.
The 1,000 jobs represent about a 0.5% increase over 2010. In his yearly assessments, Fried divides the Anchorage economy into seven major segments. All of them experienced overall employment growth over the past decade for a combined total of approximately 15,000 new jobs.
It really nice balanced growth in almost all sectors of Anchorage's economy.
This year, he predicts employment growth in five of those segments, losses in two. Of the 1,000 new jobs Fried sees for 2012, he says 700 will come from healthcare, 400 in leisure and hospitality, 300 in transportation, and 200 each in retail trade, along with professional and business services. On the negative side, construction and government. Fried says this year, construction, still impacted by the recession, could lose as many as 300 jobs in the Anchorage area.
Home building new residential units, that's felt it. Again, from a real estate standpoint, Alaska's in a very enviable place. Anchorage is in a very enviable place. But new home construction is pretty slow. It's the slowest since it was in 1990.
Commercial construction and government-initiated construction also remain spotty. The latter could be paralleled by what Fried sees as the other job loss area, government. He predicts a loss of 400 government jobs in the Anchorage area during 2012. In the past, federal dollars could be linked to about a third of Alaska's jobs and 40% of all income. In the last decade, the total of federal money coming to the state doubled to about $12.5 billion last year.
We know that's not going to be true anymore. I think we can say with pretty much a certainty it's probably going to move in the other direction. How dramatic that's going to be and when it exactly is going to start, none of us can tell. But I think that certainly growth is over with. And I would be surprised if we didn't see some declines and possibly significant declines starting in 2013 or 14.
Freed's forecast of Anchorage employment for this year appears in the January issue of Alaska Economic Trends, the monthly publication of the State Department of Labor and Workforce Development. The magazine can be found at the department's website within the Research and Analysis section. In Anchorage, I'm Len Anderson. Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
State public health workers from across the state came together for 3 days of discussions in Anchorage this week on all facets of how Alaskans can be healthier. One of the most significant health problems we're facing as a state is obesity. Like much of the nation, the numbers of those who are overweight or obese are climbing rapidly here. Britt Shimoniak is the survey manager for the section of Women, Children, and Family Health within the State Division of Public Health. She says more than 44% of Alaska women who had babies in 2010 were overweight or obese before becoming pregnant. And even more alarming is the percentage of obese young children.
And then when we talk about three-year-old children in Alaska, our prevalence is at 40%. So 40% of three-year-olds in Alaska are overweight or obese.
Carol Fink is the program manager for the state's Obesity Prevention and Control Program. She says obesity has doubled in Alaska in the past 20 years, and all that extra weight is expensive.
Chronic conditions associated with obesity, such as diabetes, heart disease, stroke, are very expensive to treat. And we're seeing, you know, $459 million spent on obesity-related health care in the state of Alaska. And it's somewhat unsustainable for us to expect to be able to pay for those. And so to prevent obesity, we need to look at what's causing it.
It's the usual suspects: lack of adequate exercise, poor diet, and too many sugary beverages. Fink says limiting the access of cheap soda in schools, at workplaces, and fundraising events is one change that other states have found helpful in fighting the epidemic of obesity. She says nearly 80% of health costs are due to chronic health conditions such as diabetes and heart disease. Knowing why people are getting fatter is a start, but Fink says it will take an all-out effort to turn it around.
We need a lot of partners, a lot of friends, and we're going to really need a multi-pronged approach that is systematic, statewide, and sustained. It can't just be a one-year effort. It's going to need to take years, and we're going to need all sectors involved, from work sites to schools to healthcare providers and individuals, to start making personal decisions about their own healthcare.
She says outreach to healthcare providers is another avenue to ensure that, just like educating smokers about the dangers of tobacco abuse, educating Alaskans about the dangers of being overweight becomes part of the consultation during visits to the doctor. The World Ice Art Championships will go on as scheduled in Fairbanks next month. A February 28th open date is set for the month-long ice carving event. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, things are coming together despite a venue change.
It's been colder than normal this month in Fairbanks, and people aren't too happy about it, even those in the ice business.
We've been, 50-some days in a row below zero? This has been a killer of a winter. We're harvesting ice earlier than we normally would because the ice is just starting to get so thick.
That's Ice Alaska Chairman Dick Brickley. He says thick ice makes the big blocks needed for carving too heavy to move, so they're getting started cutting a little earlier than normal. Brickley stood by Tuesday as the first blocks for this year's World Ice Art Championships were cut. 1,000 massive ice blocks are being sawn from a pond at Ice Alaska's new venue. It's a milestone given what the group has been through just to get to this point. After years of lease wrangling with the Alaska Railroad and facing eviction last spring from its longtime former venue, the group connected with a local family that wanted to sell a nearby property ideal for the ice event. Ice Alaska bought the land and moved in. Brickley says all the events, buildings, fences, and other infrastructure had to be taken apart, transported down the road, and reassembled at the new site about a mile away.
We've done all of this in just a little over 6 months, and we have running water, we have power, we have all the things, we'll be ready to open without a problem.
Chairman Brickley is optimistic that ICE Alaska's hundreds of volunteers will be able to pull things together. Construction is currently stalled, awaiting approval by the state fire marshal of plans for completion of large buildings that house ice carvers and provide indoor public space. Surveying what needs to be done from his pickup, Brickley says it's doable.
It looks like we yet have a lot to do, and we do, but it goes pretty fast when we really start getting a crew here and we, you know, can really start getting on it.
Brickley says the new 90-acre venue offers a better layout for sculptures, easier to view by the public, and out of the March sun's potentially melting rays. He says the bigger space will also allow for construction of a larger kids' park with longer ice slides.
We hope to make a slide that's at least 300 feet long this year, which will be, you know, fantastic.
Meanwhile, 100 competitors have signed up for the Ice Sculpting Championships, and Brickley says event sponsors are also stepping up, something he credits to Ice Alaska finally having its own land.
More people are coming, you know, on board about wanting to get involved because of the certainty that Ice Alaska is going to be around. I mean, when we invest the kind of money we have to go forward on this, it just makes sense.
Ice Alaska paid nearly $2.3 million for the new property, but is set to collect $2 million in state grant money to help pay it off. It's working to resolve environmental and other issues at the new property, which will allow transfer of the grant. Ice Alaska has big plans for becoming a year-round attraction with snow, wood, and sand carving events, a summer water slide, and a series of nationally themed houses for countries that bring carvers to its events. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A bear that lives in Kodiak appears to have insomnia. When most other Bruins are curled up in their dens, tracks of one adult male have been spotted numerous times during the last week in the fresh snow. Fish and game biologist Larry Van Dale says the bear is apparently shy of people, has no interest in dogs, and is almost exclusively nocturnal. Besides a few dumpster raids, there have been no reports of property damage or aggressive encounters. Even though the bear has not caused any trouble, Van Dale is warning people to be careful in the area. He says it's uncommon for a bear to be active near town this time of year, but it's not unprecedented. Radio caller studies on other bears show that up to 25% of adult males do not bed down for the entire winter. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jacqueline Estes and Len Anderson in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Jay Barrett in Kodiak. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD. Also, paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. Rasmussen Foundation announces a March 1st deadline to apply for individual artist awards, which provide funding directly to artists to support their creative work. Learn more by participating in one of their informational teleconferences to be held in January. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.